welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer, and I'm also a very proud New Yorker. In fact, for the last, 20 years or so, I have written a guidebook to New York annually. I consider the city my muse, and it's one of the greatest joys of my life that I get to constantly research the city. But there's a new book out. It's called That's So New York, Short and Very Short Stories About the Greatest City on Earth. It's by Dan Saltzstein and a whole bunch of other writers. And it showed me quirks and corners of the city that I didn't know about. It was a great, great read. So I have Dan Saltzstein on the line. Hey, Dan, many congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having me.
I mean this as a compliment. This is a really charming book. It's a book that you can kind of dip into because there's a lot of short parts to it, and you're going to end up a little happier after reading it.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, how did you get the idea for doing this book?
So it had a very unusual beginning. It basically was born of a viral tweet, which now seems a little antiquated. But 2 years ago, almost exactly, actually, I tweeted, just sort of popped into my head, actually a story about New York popped into my head. And I thought, let me make this a sort of open-ended question. And the question was, New Yorkers, what has been your most New York moment, or something to that effect? And I sort of put down my phone and forgot about it. And the next morning woke up and there were thousands of responses, including hundreds of good ones. And a bunch of people said, well, you got to make this into a book. And I thought, well, I can't just take people's tweets and put them into a book. So I thought about ways in which I could surround the best of those tweets with other New York related content, interviews, essays by me, by other writers, and other stuff, including some terrific illustrations.
Well, here's a weird inside baseball question. Did you have to pay the people for the tweets, or what's the legal, you know, usage of those?
So I did not have to pay them. I'm not entirely sure whether I needed to get permission, but I did. Uh-huh. And basically, by the time we reached out to people for permission, a bunch of people had already fled Twitter, but people who were still there. And people I found actually in other circuitous ways, only one person I think said no. And it wasn't an angry no. It was just sort of like, I'm a writer. I'd like to keep my stories to myself. But everyone was very excited about it. We sent them all a free book.
Nice.
And we have some great stories. And one thing that was interesting was that they, as I was going through them, they just fell very naturally into seven categories. Uh-huh. And those became the chapters of the book.
Right. And one of the categories is somewhat about the people you meet. And you have a tweet from a woman named Taming of Deshe,
they're all Twitter handles. So good luck.
Yeah, right. Taming of Deshe. She says, riding the train one winter, my coat had a big rip. Girl came up and I could tell she was going to say something. Your coat is ripped. I work for the company that makes it. If you give me your address, I'll send you a new one. She did. New coat for free. I wore it for years. And, you know, the title of the book is That's So New York. That is so New York because we live in a city with a population that's bigger than 40 of the 50 states, and also with all of these businesses there. So you're often going to see like famous people walking around or people who can influence your life. And that's why I love living here.
Yeah. And it's funny because we were talking about chapters a minute ago, that's in a chapter. I think it's in the chapter titled New Yorkers Are Actually Nice, which, I think New Yorkers, like people in lots of big cities, get sort of bad reputations for being rude or whatever. And look, I mean, it's a big city. People are in a rush. Sure. They've got things in their mind. So I think moment to moment, they can certainly be that way. And there's other tweets in the book that are evidence of that.
Yeah.
But But I do think that in the end, New Yorkers are nice. I mean, I think, you know, that story little moment is a great example. But I think, you know, New York, you know, for us New Yorkers, we've all had that moment where something happens, somebody, I don't know, falls down, or, you know, for me, it was like I was once on the subway and on the platform and somebody had a seizure and six people rushed over and one immediately was calling 911 and the other was, you know, asking for a doctor and whatever. I just feel like there's underlying that sort of veneer of, you know, I guess what some people perceive as rudeness. There's a lot of heart there. And as you said, it's also an industry town and there's all kinds of businesses. And that also could have been, there's another chapter, big city, small town, which I think is another. I mean, there's a lot of these sort of like little, you know, I don't know if you call them coincidences or just, you know, serendipitous moments that people have.
Yes. Well, my favorite coincidence in the book was a woman is carrying a live eel in her bag, and it escapes from her bag on the subway, and she very nonchalantly catches the eel, breaks its neck.
Yeah.
And what was so funny about that was not only did somebody write about it, when they tweeted about it, somebody else said, oh my goodness, I was on that train too.
Yeah, that's maybe my favorite combination of tweets. There's a few tweets that sort of go together. That was definitely the best. I mean, the story is great, and then the fact that somebody immediately on Twitter was basically, you know, like, I was on that train.
Right. Well, back to New Yorkers being kind. You have a section on the New York Hello and how people talk to one another in kind of in their neighborhoods. I hear from a lot of visitors, they stay in Times Square, which is a frenetic, difficult place to live, which is why no New Yorkers actually live there. It's just tourists. And they assume that the city is all like that, whereas we all talk to one another. We say hello to one another on the streets. We recognize our neighbors. And I thought that was a beautiful section of the book.
I agree with you. It's an essay by my friend Jason Diamond, who's a writer. He wrote from, I'm an editor at the New York Times, and he wrote for me when I was working in the travel section. He's also written a couple of books, so Searching for John Hughes and The Sprawl. And yeah, he wrote a lovely essay. And I gotta say, it's very Jason in the sense that Jason's one of those, he's a connector. You know, he really knows a lot of people in different worlds, and he loves to sort of bring them together. And the essay, is really about how, I mean, New York is a collection of neighborhoods, right? I mean, it's and every neighborhood has, and even sub neighborhoods, you know, these little areas. I mean, I live on the border of Woodside and Sunnyside in Queens, and even just within a few blocks, I would say, like, the number of times I say hello to people on the street is a lot. And it's not, that's not something that I think that you associate with New York. And maybe it's less, you know, that's less, would be less true if you're on, I don't know, you know, the Upper East Side or the West Village or something like that. But I do think that there is that quality. He talks about the sort of, you know, that neighborhoods often have mayors, you know, like people who everybody knows, they've been there forever. And, you know, he's like, he sort of thought maybe he was the mayor of his neighborhood, but then he meets this guy and he's like, oh, no, this guy is the mayor of the neighborhood.
Right.
It's a lovely essay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lovely essay. And I think dispels a lot of myths about New York. You also dig deep into the people who keep this city running. You interview a train operator, a subway operator, which is different than a conductor. So what's the difference between a conductor and an operator? And tell the listeners about the difficulties of this job. I was stunned.
Yeah. So there's four interviews with people who sort of interact with New York in very specific and different ways. And this was an interview with, as you said, a subway operator, which I also didn't know there was a distinction.
Right. The conductor makes the announcement and the operator drives the train.
So the conductor is the person in the middle of the train who opens and closes the doors. And that's the conductor. And the operator is the person at the front of the train who's actually driving it.
Right.
And when I called her a conductor, she sort of was like, well, I'm an operator. And it's like with a slightly offended tone, you know, and I was like, I'm sorry. I didn't know there was a difference. But yeah, no, it definitely is a difficult job. And I mean, you can, some of the reasons you can imagine why, I mean, it's, you're, you know, hurtling in a tube tunnel underground, you know, for hours at a time. And
they told you, I mean, they can't even pee when they need to. I mean,
yeah, she was saying, I said, I think the question was, what is the hardest part about the job? And, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, she said it was you can't go to the bathroom. And I said, what are your options? And she said, well, if it's a real emergency and you can call the control center and tell them, they call it a comfort, apparently, that you need to take a comfort. And at the next station, you have to run to the station agent, get a key to the bathroom. But of course, that's all frowned upon because they want to keep the trains moving and
right.
and so forth. So it's it does not sound like an easy job. And you know, it's a good reminder of how there are people scattered all over the city who are doing these things that we don't even think about, really.
It got a bit terrifying when she said that, you know, sometimes with the rocking of the subway, mm-hmm. she worries about falling asleep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you think about like, well, how hard could it be to drive a subway train? Apparently it's pretty hard. And that's one of the reasons, you know, and it's one of those jobs that you sort of, you know, I think the vast majority of New Yorkers probably don't even think about it, take it for granted.
Right, right. Yeah. All alone in that cabin for hours. The opposite of that, you also talk to a whole bunch of bartenders and the great, I hope I get the pronunciation of his name right. He unfortunately passed away, Sasha Petrosky.
Yeah.
He said that the purpose of drinking is to get as drunk as you can without ruining it for other people. And he kind of framed being a bartender in that way.
Yep.
And then you interview other bartenders mm-hmm. and you hear about how difficult it is to be the guy who is distributing liquids that mm-hmm. make people act oddly. And then they have to kind of, you know, deal with what happens.
Yeah. I mean, when I was thinking about different elements for the book, this was one of the ones that popped into my head first was, you know, who interacts with New Yorkers every day in a very specific way. And of course, you know, bartenders do. One thing that was interesting was a few of the bartenders that I asked to be, you know, for stories said, my attitude is what happens at my bar stays at my bar.
Huh.
And so, you know, didn't want to share stories. And that made me all the more curious. But the bartenders who did talk to me had, you know, really terrific stories about people getting injured. And Abigail Gullo, who actually no longer lives in New York, she's in New Orleans, but she was a bartender at the sadly closed not that long ago Fort Defiance in Red Hook, and for a number of years. And it was the winter 2010, and there was a huge blizzard, and she somehow managed to get to the bar. And she gets there, and the owner, whose name is Sinchin Frizzell, is sort of shocked that she made it.
Right.
But a few people in the neighborhood make it to the bar, and they watch a football game and have a few drinks. And it's just this like lovely story of like how New Yorkers, you know, sort of come together in these sort of situations.
And yeah, you have a lot in the book about snowstorms and blackouts and the other crazy things that, you know, turn city living on its head, and how we all come together.
Well,
except for the cab drivers who try and charge you like insane amounts of money.
Well, yeah, that's one of my stories was that during a separate blizzard, I think, although it's possible it's the same one, actually, where I was on my way home on the subway from Brooklyn, where my now wife lived at the time, and the whole subway system shut down, which, as New Yorkers will know, it happens very rarely. There's a lot to complain about with the MTA, but the whole system shutting down is very rare. And I was at Herald Square, and I went up to street level. And I lived in Astoria, Queens at the time, and I was still pretty far from home.
Sure.
And it was coming down really hard. And I thought, I could technically go walk to my office, which is, I don't know, was 10-ish blocks away.
So half a mile.
Right.
And listeners.
Right. But there was, to my shock, a cab on the streets that was sort of going 5 miles per hour. And I flagged him down and I asked him, is there any chance? And the only reason he took me was because he lived in Queens. And so he was going home for the night.
Right.
And he said, yeah, $100, which is probably at the time was, you know, five or six times the normal amount. But to me, it was worth it. And, you know, I'll always be indebted to that guy because who knows how I would have gotten home otherwise.
Although there was another subway and a snowstorm story in your book. And the guy is told $100 and he says, fuck you, to the guy. Yeah. And the guy goes, oh, I didn't realize you're a local. Okay, I'll take you for less.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of stories of that ilk where, you know, people have. They're not even stories. They're almost like little moments, you know, and where there's another one, which I love. My friend John had this one where he was, I'm not going to get the wording exactly right, but he's approached by two guys, clearly about to mug him. One of the guys has a gun and he says, John says, oh God, guys, you know, I've got cancer. I just came from chemotherapy. And one of the guys says, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. Hand over your wallet. You know, it's just these like, you know, these little like great, like sort of like, I don't know what to call them, bittersweet, I guess, moments, you know, where you see the humanity come through just for a second. There's sort of, there's a lot of that in the stories.
Well, what I love about the book is, I think the timing of it is really great that it's coming out now. I've noticed online, whenever anybody puts up anything about New York, like on fromers.com, when we put up a story on, I don't know, where to propose in New York or some positive, sweet story, in the comments, when we tweet or put it on Facebook, we get person after person. Oh yeah, you could propose, but the rats are going to bite your toes off, or you can propose and you'll be mugged. And the best thing about New York is to leave New York. And there's this really, I hate to use the word vicious, but as a New Yorker, that's what it feels like.
Right.
These vicious attacks on New York. And I don't understand it. I mean, we're all one country. New York's an important city. Why do people get happiness, get pleasure by trashing New York? I just don't understand it.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, I think part of it is frankly just ignorance, right? I mean, a lot of people see the New York that is portrayed in the media or in movies. You know, I always like to remind people New York is the safest large city in America.
Yep.
Statistically,
you're not just saying that. There's actual facts.
You know, per capita, there are fewer crimes in New York than any other large city.
And I've actually heard that it's safer than some rural areas.
Without question, it is. Yeah. And like I said before, I think, you know, New Yorkers can have this sort of gruff exterior.
Sure.
But that's, I think, true in any big city. I mean, people are in a rush and they, you know, I always think about my dad, who's a native New Yorker. He's from Crown Heights, Brooklyn. His favorite thing was always if he saw tourists looking at a map or, you know, in later years of phone, clearly lost or trying to find someplace, he loved going up to people and saying, oh, do you need help finding something? I mean, that was his favorite thing. And I do the same. I mean, if I can help out a tourist, you know, I do. I mean, do I get annoyed at people walking too slow on the sidewalk? Sure, I do. I really think that that New York is actually a really loving place deep down. And
even not deep down. I mean, we live on the streets here. Very few people get around in their cars.
True.
And so I feel like we are actually better practiced at getting along with people who aren't like us. Because I think I read one out of every five New Yorkers was born in a different country.
Mm-hmm.
So we are a truly diverse society.
For sure. And that's maybe something else. One of the other reasons why, you know, people react negatively is that, you know, there are large swaths of this country, obviously, that are, you know, pretty homogenous. And look, there are homogenous areas in New York, to be sure.
Absolutely.
But I live out in, as I said, in Woodside, Queens. And, you know, the most diverse place in the world is somewhere in Queens. It sort of jumps around. It's like, yeah, sometimes it's Jamaica, sometimes it's Woodside, sometimes it's East Elmhurst. And there are people in my neighborhood, in all frankness, you know, who resent it. I mean, it's Woodside is a historically Irish neighborhood, and they probably like, you know, prefer it that way. But there are other people who, including me, who love how diverse it is. I mean, I hear 3, 4, 5 languages every day, just walking around in my neighborhood. And, you know, it also means we have great food, which helps a lot. But, but yeah, I think, you know, the, you know, real New Yorkers, I think, love the diversity. And I also think it's a great, I mean, one of the things when I'm out with my daughter, who's 11, and she's sort of, you know, complaining about something, the subways or the noise or whatever. If we're like, you know, let's say we're going to a museum or something like that, I always try to remind her, look at all of these people. They came from literally all over the world to come to our city. Yeah. You know, I mean, that to me says so much. And yes, it's true. There are a lot of great museums, great restaurants, Central Park, you know, all the great things about New York. But I think that a lot of people come here just for the energy. I mean, New York has such a specific and vibrant energy. That's what I tried to capture in the book I'm glad to hear it.
No, that's what I was going to say. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and even more of a pleasure reading this book. Thank you so much, Dan, for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Thank you so much, Pauline, for having me.
Sometimes in travel, things go wrong. It's an expensive activity, and when things do go wrong, it's important to assert your rights and get some redress for what's happened to you. To help us do that today, we have Bill McGee. He is a senior fellow for the American Economic Liberties Project. He is also, we're proud to say, a columnist at Fromers.com. Hey, Bill, nice to speak with you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Pauline.
So you did a column last week about how to complain. Now, I'm not going to make you say everything like this, like whining as we speak, but complaints are a serious business, right? That they're a way to stop bad things from happening.
They really are. It's so critical, not just to defend yourself and your own rights, but you're really helping many others when you do this, particularly you know, publicize it. But there are some unique challenges with travel that make it unlike other industries. So it's not like, you know, you go to a department store or a restaurant or whatever, and you have a problem and you know how to redress it. With travel, it gets a lot trickier.
So the trickiest, I think, area is airline travel. Would that be correct, do you think?
Yes, I think airlines with cruise lines as a close second. But airlines, it's embedded in the way that the industry is regulated. We all know that in 1978, the airlines were deregulated. And as a part of that congressional act, there was something called federal preemption. Most people have never heard the term, but we deal with it every day. And what it basically means is that at the last minute, Congress added this quick little paragraph that said, only the federal government will have oversight over the airline industry in the United States. So what does that mean? It means as an American citizen, you have fewer rights when you interact with airlines than you do with virtually any other industry. And that means you can't file lawsuits in state courts as you would with virtually any other company in America, and class action suits also through state courts that state attorneys general have no authority, state legislatures have no authority. So basically, it's all up to Congress and the Department of Transportation. And if they don't act on something, there's nothing you can do. We saw this in a very dramatic way during COVID when the airlines were refusing to pay refunds. I mean, it was just out and out violation of existing law. And Secretary Chao under President Trump decided not to act. And so therefore, you know, the airlines got away with not paying something like in the order of $10 billion in refunds. And so because of that, we and others at Economic Liberties, we have said it's time to roll back this federal preemption. Any purpose it might have had in 1978 has been outlived. And now it's time for us to have the same rights as airline passengers that we have, you know, in the rest of society. Unfortunately, we're not there yet, but it's important to note that your rights are curtailed when you're dealing with airlines.
Curtailed, but there is one way to get your day in court, and that's small claims court, right?
Right. Exactly. Now, it varies tremendously from state to state. You have to take it on a state-to-state basis in terms of what the limits are. But for most airline problems, if it's not something very serious, like an accident or something like that, you can often redress through small claims. It's a more cumbersome process than it is, you know, going filing a lawsuit as you would normally. You have to sort of follow it through. But it is one area where you can sort of fight for your rights when you're dealing with the airlines.
Right. And you said that the second most difficult area is cruising. And I'm guessing that's because there's no such thing really as an American cruise line. We may think of Carnival as being an American company, but it's flagged elsewhere. In fact, all of these major cruise lines are members of other nationalities, usually the ones that tax them the least, right?
Right, exactly. They fly, you know, flags from all over the world. And in fact, one of the few exceptions was American Queen Voyages, which was in fact a U.S.-based company. But unfortunately, as we know, they just shut down in February. The Federal Maritime Commission has a notice on its website, which is rather disturbing, I think, for a lot of consumers. It says that, quote, there is no federal government agency that regulates cruise customer service issues like itinerary changes, passenger cancellations, cabin concerns. And the FMC has very limited jurisdiction over cruise lines, even in U.S. waters. So that's a very sobering thing to realize. They're more or less saying that it's complete laissez-faire and you are on your own. So we may think of you know, some of the big cruise lines like Carnival, like you mentioned, as having a big presence in the U.S. They have marketing offices here and sales offices, but they are not incorporated here, and the ships fly foreign flags. And so even in U.S. waters, your rights are very greatly curtailed.
So what can you do should something go wrong on a cruise ship or with a booking for a cruise ship?
Right. For Americans that are booking here in the United States, you can't stress it enough. You need to book with a credit card for all travel purchases. It's not even conceivable that in 2024 you might be thinking of using a check, as some people do through their travel agency, or cash, you know. You have to use a credit card. Why? Because there's something called the Fair Credit Billing Act. And that only applies if you book in the United States. So there's caveats. There's always a lot of asterisks with all these rules, right? But if you book a trip in the United States and it is not delivered, that's how the product is not delivered is how it's worded, meaning the company went bankrupt or the company canceled the flight or canceled the reservation or canceled the sailing.
Or put you in a different class of cabin? Could it
absolutely
be something?
Okay. Yeah. You're not delivered the product that you paid for. Then you, through the Fair Credit Billing Act, you have to act swiftly. You can't wait 6 months or a year, but you need to go contact your credit card company, your bank, whatever the issuer is for the credit card, and get the refund through them. Then on the back end, they'll fight it out with the company, but that's not your problem anymore.
And I guess it's the same solution for other foreign types of vacations. So if you book a tour through a foreign company or a safari or some other type of travel product, you're going to be subject to the laws of that jurisdiction, and who the hell knows what those laws are.
Exactly.
So it's best to deal with your credit card.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the if we tried to create a chart for every country in the world with the rules here, it would look like what we used to call phone books, but we never see anymore.
Right.
What some of us remember, right? So having said that, an important thing to remember, we found this out the hard way a couple of years back when I was at Consumer Reports. We got a complaint from an American citizen who had booked a trip, and we said, okay, Fair Credit Billing Act. And in engaging with her, we found out that she had actually booked it when she was overseas, even though she was an American citizen. And it did not fall under the Fair Credit Billing Act because of that. That's one of those loopholes. So book here in the States before you go, use a credit card, make sure you have all your records of all your transactions. Look, I have OCD, so for me, this is an eye roll. You know, it's like, of course I have all my records, but you'd be shocked when, you know, you talk to people and it's like, well, I don't know what flight it was. I don't know what date it was. I don't remember which property it was. You know, you have to keep records of all of that stuff. We have found that vague complaints are the first ones to get tossed out. If you can write a detailed complaint and also keep it brief, nobody needs to know, you know, the details of how you missed your uncle's wedding and, you know,
sure,
how much it cost and all that. Keep to the facts, you know, the dates, the times, get names of people that you talk to when there are problems like a flight cancellation. But you need to be able to back up what you're claiming.
Now, is it easier to get money back through complaints about hotels or rentals within the United States? So we're not talking foreign right now, just domestic.
Well, you do have more rights with hotels and car rentals because they don't have that federal preemption clause that the airlines have, and they don't have the, you know, that FMC statement that, well, you're sort of on your own. It's, you know, caveat emptor.
What is FMC?
I'm sorry, the Federal Maritime Commission. With car rentals and hotels, a good way to go is filing complaints through the Federal Trade Commission. They will oversee those industries. And also with state attorneys general, it's very easy to find the offices in all 50 states for your attorney general, and they all have consumer offices. Some of them are very detailed when it comes to travel. New York State, for example, has an entire page on their website just devoted to travel issues and how to go about filing complaints.
Well, let me ask you, though, do you file in the state you live in, or do you file in the state where the thing happened?
That's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. And I've seen people do both, actually. You know, you live in Virginia, but you had a problem with a hotel in Minneapolis and you file in Minnesota. You know, it's usually best, we think, as a rule, to file in the state where you live, because that they're going to act for their own citizens, I think, you know, fair to say, before they start acting, you know, on behalf of folks that live out of state.
And finally, the specter of bankruptcy is now upon us because of American Queen, which is actually owner of many, many companies, including Hornblower. And I believe it's Hornblower that does the ferries to the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island. And I mean, Hornblower is everywhere.
Yeah.
If
right.
you have a trip booked, not just with American Queen, but with one of its other subsidiaries, what do you do?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a tough situation because, you know, and I've been there myself. I was an employee at two airlines that went bankrupt. And, you know, when there's a bankruptcy, I mean, we're talking not talking about a Chapter 11 reorganization, but a Chapter 7 where you shut down, then the creditors start lining up. And, you know, I remember being on a very long line and very far back in that line as a low paid employee behind, you know, companies like Boeing that had a lot more, you know, juice than I had to get my claim in, right? So if you're going to be paid 10 cents on the dollar, it's, you know, you're talking about a fraction of what you're due. The fact is that with bankruptcies, it's one area where if it's a big ticket item, you might want to think about travel insurance, but you want to read that policy carefully. And also, you don't want to buy the travel insurance through the very company that may go bankrupt on you. And
sure.
I know that sounds crazy, but people do it. You know, you book through a travel agency or a tour operator, and guess what? They go bankrupt, and there goes your travel insurance policy.
Right.
But you have to read those exclusions. I know there's a lot of fine print because there's a lot of caveats in travel insurance policies.
And it's too late to get travel insurance for American Queen.
Right, I mean, exactly. These things are never retroactive, right?
Right.
Or else everybody would do that. You know, you have situations like where with severe weather, if a storm is named by the National Weather Service and it suddenly becomes, you know, Hurricane Aaron, you're done now. You cannot buy travel insurance anymore. It's been, you
right.
know, officially designated a problem, and now you can't buy insurance. So yes, the earlier the better on these things, but you really have to read the fine print.
So if you don't have the insurance and you are now currently a customer for American Queen, what do you right. do?
So specifically in the case of American Queen, to their credit, they do have a notice on their website. It's still active, and it tells you how to go about filing a claim. Often companies do that. Sometimes, though, they just disappear, and you go to the website, and you get a sign with a big wrench on it, right, saying, see ya. In those cases, it's going to be up to you to do a little homework and to find out where the filing was, you know, which you can usually find with a Google search, and then, you know, appeal directly to the court. But in this case, you know, they do seem to be making it a little easier for consumers.
Right, right. Well, it's a very interesting, very important article. Thank you so much for writing it for Fromers.com and kind of breaking it down for everybody here.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I love working with you on these topics. And needless to say, we've got a lot more to do this year. There's a lot going on in travel.
Oh, so yeah.
We're never going to get to the point where it's like, gee, there's nothing to write about this week. You know, it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Well, we also talk about the happy things in travel. And I plan to do that not next week, but the week after next. I'm taking next week off because I'm going to be in Italy. So please enjoy your time away from me. Wish me bon voyage. And may I do the same to anybody who is traveling. As my father always said at the end of all of his radio shows, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage. And I'll see you in 2 weeks.